White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker in North Central Indiana, where it's wet as hell outside. Boy, we're getting some big rains today. And it is the 10th of September, 2014, on Wotan's Day, Dave Lane's favorite day. Our P.O. Box, our address is P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the daily radio show and for any other projects that you'd like to contribute to, like our POW campaign. We send some money each month into certain select POWs. And also we send other literature, including books, to POWs and just plain prisoners that write us, and we send them what we can. They send us a few stamps, but we can use some underwriting on that score, too. And if you run into a problem that you need to talk to the webmaster at resist.com, then go to resist merchandise, resist@yahoo.com. Now, you haven't heard from Walter Dennis for a while. You probably didn't even know his name. But I think we need to refresh his speech every once in a while, so here we go.
This is Walter Dennis. I'd like to ask you something. What would America's founding fathers have done if they knew that someday a black man would be president of the United States? Our first president, George Washington, and many of his compatriots owned thousands of Negro slaves. Others, such as Thomas Jefferson, tried deporting America's black population to a West African state still known as Liberia. He wrote into the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, that a Negro shall be considered only 3/5 of a person, a non-citizen, unable to vote. Today, if you travel to our nation's capital, you'll read the following words inscribed in stone on the Jefferson Memorial. Quote, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free," unquote. Thomas Jefferson's statement is allowed to end there, leaving visitors with the impression that our third president was a liberal integrationist. But this quotation from his autobiography has been taken out of its original context. Someone has selectively deleted the rest of Jefferson's words, which are, quote, "Nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. Nature, habit, opinion have drawn indelible lines of distinction between them," unquote. But what about Abraham Lincoln? He freed the slaves, so he must have loved them. Liberals like to imagine that by calling upon his memory, they lend authority to their racially integrated agendas. But this is what Lincoln said during his fourth presidential debate on September 18, 1858. Quote, "I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the black and white races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the black and white races which will ever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race," unquote. Today, any politician running for public office, in fact, anyone making such a statement, would be loudly condemned as a racist of the worst possible kind, expelled from school or fired from his job, and arrested on charges of committing a hate crime. Yet, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington are supposed to be our country's great icons. No teacher, No one in the news or entertainment media will ever tell you what these men actually believed about so-called Afro-Americans. Nor will they tell you that blacks are responsible for more than 80% of violent crimes committed in our country, even though Negroes make up just 12% of its population. That must come as a shock to regular viewers of television, where blacks are around half the faces seen on the tube. Unlike their real-life versions, televised blacks are almost invariably portrayed as pitiful victims of injustice at the hands of white bigots, or lovable heroes deserving our adoration and emulation. This is because television is nothing more than a backed-up toilet overflowing with lies. It is a font of poison floating with stinking falsehoods in which truth dies and sinks. Beginning after the turn of the last century, race-mixing propagandists have taken particular delight in elevating half-breeds to superstar status. Television personalities and political celebrities of black and white parentage are more often placed upon the highest public pedestals for special homage. At the same time, no opportunity is missed to promote racially mixed unions, typically of a blonde white woman to a blue-black male, together with the couple's half-breed offspring, which invariably take after their African father. When we look around the world at racially mixed countries, we find such exotic lands as India, Morocco, and Mexico. These places are human garbage dumps, characterized by squalor, violence, starvation, filth, and disease on a colossal scale of hopeless misery. They were not always so. 4,000 years ago, a civilization of clean-swept boulevards and magnificent public baths flourished throughout the Indus Valley. 2,000 years later, Morocco was set with marble temples and gleaming health spas, a jewel in the crown of the Roman Empire. 500 years ago, conquistadors from Spain raised a prosperous colony upon the ruins of Aztec Indian human sacrifice and cannibalism. All of these formerly high cultures in Mexico, Morocco, and India were created exclusively by white civilizers. While colored natives may have supplied some of the labor, civilization was the product of white genius. So long as the white master builders preserved their dominance and racial integrity, society functioned as intended. But as they interbred with Negroes and other lowlife, white identity drowned in a raceless morass of darkening generations that bore less and less resemblance to their fair-skinned founding fathers. Their originally high intelligence level sank into an increasingly dumber and savage population. The once splendid civilizations of the Indus Valley, Central America, and North Africa decayed into the rotting urban centers now known as New Delhi, Tijuana, or Marrakesh. America stands in the same shadow that eventually reduced these formerly civilized centers to subhuman cesspools. Such putrid places graphically represent the goal set for our country by fanatic integrationists who embrace race mixing with all the fervor of religious extremists. Their aim is to reduce the United States to another Bangladesh or Sudan. The mass murderers of our posterity flaunt their sympathy for the colored downtrodden of this world in order to parade what they imagine is a kind of moral superiority over everyone else. These people are truly insane. Their real core motivation is a psychopathic loathing for everything and everyone white. That only can explain such hysterical intolerance of the slightest criticism for the race-mixed utopia they demand. They cannot work fast enough for the eventual extirpation of the white race through wholesale interbreeding with Congoid apes. Their aim is the dissolution of all the world's races into a single global souffle of genetic excrement. And anyone who raises an objection to their high-minded nightmare is condemned and ostracized as a racist, an enemy to what is ever fair and good. Yet, what we take for granted today as civilization is the exclusive product of white men and women. From computers and hair curlers to bicycles and space shuttles, everything we know as modern technology was brought about entirely by white inventors. It stands to reason that when their kind no longer exists, their creations will disintegrate, just like old American cars falling apart in the littered streets of Mexico City. While white people were building great civilizations around the world for the last 5,000 years, blacks in Africa never figured out how to make a wheel. They never built anything more substantial than a mud hut. They knew nothing about metal, glass, or tool. They never had a written language. Their technology did not extend beyond the tip of their wood spears. Their only medicine was voodoo. They never sailed on anything greater than a floating log, even though they resided along thousands of miles of coastline. And all this centuries before they could claim slavery as an excuse for their utter lack of know-how. They never put one stone upon another, thought of a light bulb, invented an airplane, designed a fountain pen, wrote a poem, painted a portrait, or initiated anything associated with civilized life. Although Afro-Americans have come to benefit from these things and more, they created none of them. They have always excelled, however, in those activities which characterize them best: violent behavior and monumental squalor. For proof, drive through the south side of Chicago, into Gary, Indiana, or black streets in any metropolitan area, if you dare. There you will see old, rotting buildings tottering above gang-infested sinkholes of urban filth. These are the ruins of white civilization, microcosms for what the rest of America is becoming. This national decay translates itself into escalating murders, assaults, rapes, robberies, and a virtual tidal wave of atrocities committed daily against white men, women, and children. Considered more important than their own self-defense, they are cautioned against racism when identifying their dark assailants. Because followers of the race-mixing dogma are indifferent to these white victims, outsiders rarely learn of their fate. They are not showcased on television, nor featured on the front page of a major newspaper. For example, a few years ago, charges were leveled against Duke University students accused of gang raping an innocent black girl. Months before the high-profile case collapsed because their ultra-liberal prosecutor was disbarred for falsifying the evidence against them, and the accuser herself turned out to be a lying half-wit, they were tried and found guilty by every major American newspaper and television network. The young white men were simultaneously and universally castigated as racists of the most awful type, meriting the severest punishment. Reverends Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson made daily telecasts deploring the climate of intolerance and sick racism that pervades our country. FBI spokesman speculated that the alleged gang rape was a hate crime. Social services liberals swung into action to provide counseling and financial assistance for the bogus black victim and her family. While the falsely accused white students were being vilified across the nation week after week, Americans were pointedly not informed of another, this time authentic atrocity that was absolutely boycotted, deliberately ignored, hushed up, even censored from public knowledge. In a successful effort to contain all outside awareness of the story, no network anchorman or mainstream reporter announced the arrest in Kentucky of four black men and one black female for perpetrating some of the most ghastly crimes ever committed in U.S. history. They were accused of abducting and murdering a young white couple. While his girlfriend looked on, they castrated Christopher Newsom, 24, then burned him alive and fired several shots into him. Over the next several days, the satanic savages beat and raped his girlfriend, Shannon Christian, 23, and took turns urinating on her. On the fourth day, they cut off her breasts, stuffed a large variety of toxic chemicals, including floor cleaner, into her mouth, then slowly stabbed her to death. Not a word about this unspeakable crime was heard on the nightly news, because NBC, CBS, CNN, ABC, Fox, and all the rest of the alphabetical deceivers were obsessed at the time with the phony Duke University rape case. There was no appeal to the sensitivities of millions of regular viewers. No social services liberals thought to comfort the families of the white victims. The torture and murder of two young white people by five blacks is not a hate crime in the FBI's book, and Reverends Sharpton and Jackson had nothing to say. Their silence is part of the deliberate censorship of any information harmful to the artificial, false image of blacks perpetrated by America's news media masters. They realize that such censorship of the truth is vital to their race-mixing agenda. Yet we are invited to embrace these killer gorillas as our equals, no, as our physical, moral, and intellectual superiors. What then can we expect for the future? Unchecked, the forces of decline will climax in mid-century. Given the continuous and accelerating inundation of the United States by waves of immigrants from south of the border, Africa, Asia, India, and the Middle East, our continent's white population will have slipped to minority status before 2050. By then, our race will have become so polluted through interbreeding with subhumans, its identity will be progressively marginalized until it no longer exists. The next 40 years will also witness America's inevitable economic conquest by Red China and India, the very countries past U.S. presidents were so anxious to assist. Our standard of living will plummet to levels comparable with Ecuador or Somalia. Companies and businesses here will be largely Asian-owned, and Americans will have to work for mostly colored bosses. The U.S. dollar will eventually become so weak it must be replaced by some international currency. With health care largely in the hands of physicians from Pakistan or the Philippines, medical help will be rendered virtually useless, and certainly unable to keep pace with too many viral strains introduced by the endless deluge of germ-carrying colored immigrants. As in any fundamental social dislocation, a tsunami of criminal bloodshed will sweep across North America. Since white people by then will have been disarmed by gun control fanatics, their spirit of resistance diluted by decades of instilled health self-hatred, and all police forces predominantly black and brown, pale-faced victims can expect little protection and less mercy. They will suffer the same kind of massacres carried out in the past against hapless whites by Indian savages on the American plains. By then, the Bill of Rights promised that, quote, the right of the people to bear arms, unquote, will have been wiped away by the enemies of white America. One of its most prominent founders, Thomas Jefferson, insisted that, quote, no free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms against tyranny in government. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants, unquote. In the years to come, only ruins and garbage will be left to show that the world was once inhabited by temporarily civilized but ultimately self-destructive human beings. Sounds like a rather bleak scenario for the future. That certainly is what the evangelists of race mixing want us to believe. Things have gone too far for some white Americans. They have given up without a fight, resigned themselves and their posterity to defeat and oblivion. They point out the shameful fact that a black man, worse, a mongrel half-breed, is now President of the United States. It was not the combined support of Negroes and Hispanics that won the election for him. Their endorsement could have been expected. No, he was voluntarily installed in the White House by a solid majority of white voters, the same people being exterminated by the very elements he himself personally embodies. More than 65 years ago, Adolf Hitler warned U.S. servicemen during World War II that their taking up arms against his racially aware country would inevitably backfire on them by putting a Negro in the White House. They laughed at him. The vast majority of white Americans in the 1940s regarded blacks then as little more than subhuman clowns, hardly worthy of attention. The very notion of a black-faced president had more in common with a comedy skit than anything in the foreseeable future. Yet, some of those Second World War veterans who once thought Hitler's prediction so amusing are no longer laughing. A colored chief executive was unthinkable, ludicrous even, until the early 1970s, when big city mayoral positions and state governorships were first occupied by Negroes. If a black mayor, some argued, why not a black president someday? Coincidental with the blacks advancing political power, all mainstream avenues of public information joined at every level of education to wring the last ounce of racial self-respect from our people. They were psychologically conditioned to embrace every manifestation of racial suicide in a comprehensive campaign as ubiquitous as it was relentless. A two-prong attack morally undercut white Americans by stressing their original sin of racism while constantly heroizing blacks as altogether superior, lovable creatures. Only decades of unrelieved and concerted propaganda made a Negro president possible. Without this incessant programming, such an incomparable disgrace would never have come to pass. Blacks are self-evidently too dim-witted to have achieved anything on their own. They represent merely a means to an end, namely the lethal pollution of our race. Once the white people have been poisoned by interbreeding, they disappear forever from the face of the earth, never to return. The original white builders of Egypt, Iran, Persia, India, and all the other lands that so long ago flourished utterly vanished, their formerly vibrant cultures reduced to dead ruins when they renounced the irreplaceable heritage of their pure blood. Racially weakened, their societies were beset by uncontrollable criminal violence, moral rot, economic collapse, political corruption, and cultural decay, until foreigners obliterated them. As the historian Will Durant warned us during the last century, quote, "A great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within," unquote. America is not exempt from that iron law, with Red China poised to take over from the United States as the next superpower. Accordingly, the U.S. seems doomed to repeat the same kind of suicide committed by past civilizations, and nothing can be done to stop it, so long as the majority of Americans are either indifferent to their country's fate or actually aiding and abetting it. So, what are you going to do? Let it go? Will you allow yourself to be pushed into the background and told to shut up, afraid to raise your voice in a feeble word of protest? Isn't there anything you can do that really matters? There is, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with complaining to your congressman, signing petitions, or writing to a newspaper editor. Your enemies brush aside such obsolete methods with a contemptuous laugh. The very first thing you have got to do is get mad. No one can do anything really meaningful unless they're consumed with justifiable anger. God knows you have more to be enraged about than you can even imagine. But you know enough about white kids beaten by Afro-American gangsters. You know enough about white women raped and tortured by black monsters. You know enough about the anti-white lies you're supposed to swallow in silence. You've got to get up and shout in the face of your enemy, "I'm a white American, damn it, and I'm not going to take your race-mixing crap anymore." The psychotic Negrophiles are quick to denounce and label anyone who fails to embrace their savage yahoos as haters. But if you cannot hate someone who threatens your own loved ones with suffering and death, you're a failure as a human being. Anyone who won't defend those they love for fear of giving offense is a worthless coward. We can and will no longer be silenced by the race-mixing bullies pushing our world towards extinction. We will no longer be made ashamed of being white while others insist on black pride. We will not allow ourselves to be weakened by all those numerous, relatively petty differences that divide white men and keep us from forming a united front against the haters of our betrayed people. Those differences, how otherwise significant they may seem, must be put aside and not allowed to deflect one degree from our unity as white men and women. We must draw our wagons into a circle, close up our ranks in an unbreakable flank. Political, religious, class, ideological, or any of the other sorts of differences that threaten to divide our racial solidarity must be avoided. All that counts now is our self-awareness as white men and women. And anyone who attempts to detract one ounce from our racial unity has joined the enemies of white America. That the majority hates us or simply doesn't care about the survival of white America means nothing. When George Washington and his fellow revolutionaries took on the British Empire, the most powerful machine of its kind on earth, they were opposed by a solid majority of their own countrymen. Most people couldn't have cared less one way or the other. More than a third of Americans hated the Patriots, who were supported by just 15% of the colonial population. And from that small minority, only a fractional percentage actually participated in the war for independence. Yet, these few activists, against the will of a pro-British majority, themselves embodied a majority of willpower and energy to expel powerful invaders from our country. The American patriots who achieved this miracle were not liberals. They did not love their enemies. They were proud to be robust haters of the foreigners who imposed a frightful tyranny on the United States. The same situation confronts us today. Most white Americans are indifferent to the present decline and future destruction of their own race. To them, the only things that matter are making money and wasting their lives watching television. A majority of our fellow countrymen and women have been reduced to brainwashed lemmings, but not all of them. National election results for the past few years, where race-conscious candidates have run for office, have conclusively shown that 15% of our people understand and loathe the anti-white haters who have pushed us to the brink of extinction. That doesn't sound like much, but 15% of the U.S. population fleshes out into 37 million race-conscious white Americans. Within those 37 million lies a 3% minority of 75,000 potential activists, a veritable army of warriors. The chief task of the anti-white establishment has always been to drive a wedge between the 37 million white people who have not yet lost their souls to race mixing and the 75,000 fighters who can lead them to victory over the corruptors of our racial integrity. Anyone who can appreciate the high significance of these percentages understands at once that he or she is not an isolated individual, a freak for refusing to embrace the race-mixed propaganda of our times, unlike most everyone else. On the contrary, there are millions and millions of white Americans just as inwardly disgusted and repelled by the colored pollution of our people as we are ourselves. These numbers may encourage us, but our resistance must not depend on them. If the spirits of America's proudly racist founding fathers could return to see how we, their descendants, have allowed the liberty they fought and died for to have been stolen by repulsive fugitives from the African jungle, they would command us as Patrick Henry did. "We must fight," he said. Listen to these words he spoke more than 200 years ago. Quote, "I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and the God of hosts is all that is left to us. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense, I should consider myself as guilty of treason toward my country. Why stand we here idle? What is it that the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." Unquote. That is the real American spirit that defied all the powers of hell and stood up to the hostile majority and won. It is a spirit no longer seen in our fellow countrymen because they have been lulled to sleep by the criminal conspirators against our lives, our liberty, and our posterity. How many more of our friends and family have to be mugged by black or Hispanic cowardly punks before you're mad enough to fight? How many more white kids are you going to allow to be beaten by colored gangbangers? How many more formerly white women must mate with darksome subhumans and bear their degraded offspring before our race is bred out of existence? For God's sake, man, get some guts! If you think things are bad now, just wait until 2040. When white people slip to minority status in the U.S. We've already become a minority in the American Southwest and in major cities such as Chicago, where the white residents have been reduced to just one quarter of the total population, with a resultant spike in violent crime across the Windy City. today, white people are already outnumbered by 8-to-1 odds on Earth. The American countdown has begun. Every 29 seconds, another illegal alien penetrates the United States. Every 10 minutes, another poisonous half-breed is spawned inside our borders. These hard facts embody the harsh truth about the real condition of our country. Get this through your head. America is threatened with death. Our struggle is for nothing less than our survival. Nothing in our lives is more important. No sacrifice we can make on its behalf too great. This struggle also ennobles us, however. It provides anyone who personally champions its cause the highest self-respect, because it embodies the brightest truth in this age of lies. The truth, hidden or knocked to the ground, always rises again to reveal itself. But it is not enough to see through the anti-white bias of our day. In itself, the most magnificent sword is no more than an inanimate object until someone has the courage to grasp it firmly by the handle and wield it against his enemies. So too, a hidden truth is worthless until it is unsheathed and used to boldly cut down all liars. Patrick Henry and his fellow patriots knew the hard truth of their times and were brave enough to raise it in defense of liberty. They were not black or Latino or Jewish or octoroon, such as that racial anomaly in the White House. His installation is only a benchmark in the death of the United States. More significantly, however, it is a national wake-up call that remaining 15% of white Americans yet aware of their own racial identity can hear and understand. It means that the hour for their survival is very late. The alarm is blaring with terrible urgency. Let that same signal also reignite the revolutionary spark of our white forefathers. Let it catch your own soul on fire and spread its flames across our betrayed nation. Some 65 years ago, a nameless hero, long among millions of warriors, declared, quote, "In times of gravest danger, the soul of our people erupts with elemental force to fend off all mortal blows and to assert itself. The soul's energy proves itself stronger than any numerical or material superiority. General readiness escalates to the highest action. What does his life mean to the individual if the sacred life of his race is threatened? He sacrifices himself so that that greater life is won. Superhuman feats are performed, and the word impossible is no longer known." Unquote. White America isn't dead yet. On the contrary, the sleeping giant is stirring from his propaganda-induced trance. And when he fully awakens, the puny enemies and congenital liars that scheme to kill him in his sleep will scatter like diseased vermin at the sight of his all-consuming rage. On your feet, white man! Stand up and fight!
There you go, boys and girls. Do I need to explain that to you? Do I need to spell it out? Do I need to send you an email? He gave it to you straight. He didn't put any sugar in it either. He gave it to you straight. And you need to listen to this every once in a while to get back on track, because we all tend to get a little bit off track from now once in a while. This speech puts you back on track of who your enemies and who your friends are and what's going on in this country. Now I'm going to play a little piece about this filthy son of a bitch, Casey. Well, Casey was the head of the CIA. That wasn't who I meant. He was a son of a bitch, too. Cheney. Richard Cheney, who was Vice President of the United States under that filthy, rotten George Bush Jr. that got together with equally rotten Clinton in Washington a couple of days ago, schmoozing. Both were war criminals. Clinton sent our forces into Serbia, bombing and killing people all over the place. We had no business there. That was strictly a problem they had over there. And now, today, Cheney, Dick Cheney, is in closed session before the House of Horrors, that's W-H-O-R-E-S, in Washington, D.C., behind closed doors to tell them what we've got to do about ISIS. The guy that got us into the Iraq mess, yes, he was running the show. It wasn't that stupid idiot from Texas. He was running the show. But I want you to hear what he said a few years before we invaded Iraq. After the first go at the situation in the Middle East. Number one, I want you to understand, I have no enemies in the Middle East. Unless they come here and become my enemy. Our enemies are here. All our enemies that can really hurt us are here, not over there. Don't let anybody talk you into joining the military and going to the Middle East or any place else. You need to defend your country here, your race here, not over there. That is a con game, superior con game. So listen to this little clip of what this warmongering son of a bitch Cheney said a few years before George Bush and him decided to go into Iraq.
Congress got paid a visit yesterday by Dick Cheney. He went and visited his old buddies in the House of Representatives. He went down there to sell them on aggressive military action against ISIS, which presumably is somewhat in support of the president. But, of course, it's Dick Cheney. So behind, in this closed-door meeting, Republicans are now out there saying that, according to John Fleming, who's a Republican from Louisiana, Dick Cheney told the group that Barack Obama has done things that have supported the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood is the beginning of all Islamist groups that we're dealing with now, like Hamas and ISIS. That our policies have been the exact opposite of where they should be. Because, yay. Dick Cheney. I mean, we played this clip before, but let me pull this up one more time. This was Dick Cheney in 1994. And if only Dick Cheney in 2003 had listened to Dick Cheney in 1994, the world would be a different place. Play me Dick Cheney in 1994.
So you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west, part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take Iraq. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact that we were able to do our job with as few casualties as we had. But for the 146 Americans killed in action and for their families, it wasn't a cheap war. And the question for the president in terms of whether or not we went on to Baghdad and took additional casualties in an effort to get Saddam Hussein was how many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
So 146 dead Americans is too high a price. But thousands of dead Americans that you caused a decade later, was A-OK. I mean, the idea that Dick Cheney is who Republicans want to listen to, the idea that Dick Cheney, whose policies created the environment where ISIS exists, because look, if we hadn't gone to Iraq in 2003, there would be no ISIS. Period. Will there be Saddam? But there would be no ISIS. So what you are saying, what you are putting forward, is a, what you are suggesting, the idea that Barack Obama is at fault because he didn't want to leave our troops in Iraq for 100 years. Because we were going to be greeted as liberators. Remember that it was going to be easy. They were going to be dancing in the streets celebrating us. Celebrating our arrival. Celebrating their freedom from Saddam. That we would win the war and win the peace and pay for it all with oil revenue and be home with time to spare. I'm mystified. Mystified. That at the amnesia that exists on the right to what the world that their foreign policies created a decade ago. I'm mystified at the amnesia that exists surrounding what happened last year when Barack Obama tried to bomb Syria. I'm mystified at the level of denial that the Republican Party takes on. I'm just, you know, we live in a strange, strange culture where the people who get condemned in the foreign policy sector, the ones who aren't taken seriously, are the ones who were right, are the ones who correctly said, hey, pause for a second. Should we really be invading Iraq? Is that really the right thing to do right now? The ones who were saying those people are traitorous, that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, that he is the most dangerous person in the world, those are the people we are still listening to. The fact that Dick Cheney gets any respect from anybody is the greatest mystery in the world to me. How deluded do you have to be to think that he is the cat's meow? To think after being as wrong as he was, being as incorrect as he was as to our place in the world, being as stupid as he was, with the amount of hubris that he and George W. Bush had about our invasion of Iraq, that he should still be listened to, is unbelievable to me. Why would you listen to this guy? Why? Why would you invite? Why is he the person you are calling in for foreign policy advice? Why? Please, I really would like to know. I really would like to understand this. One day somebody will explain to me why Dick Cheney is a person that you would want to listen to. One day somebody will explain it to me. Please, I just beg you. Can we just all agree? Can we just, as a stipulated fact, can we all agree that we will no longer listen to Dick Cheney on foreign policy? How can we just stipulate that? Can we just honestly look at each other and say, you know what? Yeah, he kind of screwed up. And he can retire now and go be rich in Wyoming, do whatever he does, take care of his heart. May he live long and prosper. But we will not listen to him on foreign policy or on anything. What? How does screwing up the country, taking us trillions of dollars in debt for a stupid war? And by the way, that's the other thing. All these Republicans who say deficit, 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 and then say, we need to be bombing everywhere. How do those two things work out? Please. Somebody tell me. I am so confused by this. We'll be back here.
Yeah, I want you to explain that to me, too. How come people are so stupid as to understand they're trying to solve the deficit problem by waging trillion-dollar wars and not wars of occupation all around the world, maintaining hundreds and hundreds of bases all over the place? Everybody's crying about the roads. Everybody's crying about the schools. Everybody's crying about the environment. Everybody's crying about all kinds of things. But they don't cry about wars of occupation and subjugation. And they don't care. You see, the only way to stop the problem, or at least minimize it in the Middle East, is to back off. Get out of there. But you know why they won't get out of there? You know why. Oil, minerals, all kinds of things that the corporations want. Saudi Arabia, probably our worst enemy in the Middle East, is an ally, supposed ally, where they're chopping heads off to the rate of about 20 a month. But we worry about ISIS. Back away. The thing that keeps these people together in the Middle East to keep warring against us is being there. If we weren't there, they'd have problems with each other and they'd work it out. Or maybe they wouldn't, but that's their problem, not ours. But I mean, it's unbelievable the people eulogize and almost genuflect and pray to these filthy, warmongering politicians like George Bush Jr., Clinton, and all these guys. They're total psychopathic warmongers. At the end of that little statement I played there, the announcer said he wished Cheney to do well. No, I wish Cheney would drop dead. I wish that heart, and I wish the person, whoever they got the heart from, would not have would add a stipulation, give it to anybody but Cheney. The day that man drops dead, I'm going to be celebrating in the street. I'll probably buy me a fifth of good bourbon, drink part of it. Yeah. But we can't go on like this. The white race can't go on like this. Like I say, our enemies are here inside our borders, centered in Washington, D.C., in the Pentagon and Wall Street. So we're not that much different than a lot of the progressives. They don't agree with us on the race issue, but on other issues we do agree. And there's got to be some kind of coming together on the issues we agree on. Because neither group can do it alone. Now, you're going to hear all these right-wing talk show people pushing to go in there and bomb everybody again. Go after ISIS. But ISIS, if you go in there to bomb them, they're just going to spread out and go to different places and break up. and you're not going to get them. You're not going to win over there. There is no winning anyhow in these wars where thousands and thousands of people die. So you might want to call your congressman, not that he'll do anything about it, but to tell him how you think it's an insult to the American people and the people who died thinking they were fighting for this country, that Dick Cheney is in close session, or was in close session yesterday, with these other filthy, rotten politicians who are going to come home and say, oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, I want to tell you something. I spent years as a really opponent of the Democrat Party. However, I ran as a Democrat because I wanted to run as a white working man. But I've discovered over the years that even though the Democrat Party is screwed up royally, they're not the biggest warmongers. Some of them are, but most of them aren't. And Obama's been set up as a step and fetch it. He may realize that he's being used as nothing but step and fetch it. They put big money to get him in there so that the Republican Party can be the Manchurian candidate. If you've never seen the original Manchurian candidate with Frank Sinatra in it, watch it and find out how it works. And the persons you think are the worst enemies turn out not to be the worst enemies. And that's the Republican Party that's still selling mom and pumpkin pie, and let's all go to church on Sunday. But inside, they're full of maggots. Well, not every Republican is, but if you're stupid and you go along with obvious crimes, then you become a party to the crimes. Everybody that's voting for these people, and they have the information's all available. Everybody that's voting for these Republicans or a Democrat that says the same thing are participating in a conspiracy. And there should be no sympathy showed for them, those people, because the information's out there. It's all over the place. But they're still following these homicidal maniacs at the head of their party and in Washington, D.C., and it looks like Obama, to his credit, was trying to back out. We did get out of Iraq the first time, but now they're all going after him again, trying to push him into bombing everybody again. I'm not an Obama fan, but when he does the right thing, I'm going to say it's the right thing. They're blaming him. They're blaming him, who's a little bit more of a pacifist. These warmongering bastards. Well, that's about it. And don't forget the Manchurian candidate. See who the bad guys turn out to be. Of course, you know that Cheney obviously was a major stockholder in Halliburton that made billions over there in the Middle East wars. That's what it's all about. Halliburton was up to their neck in the Gulf oil spill. All these corporations are doing very criminal things to the earth and to the people and to the countries that they're economically and corporately occupying. They're corporate predators, capitalist predators. Now, a lot of people don't understand it. Back when there was slavery, that was agrarian capitalism, bringing thousands and thousands of cheap labor people into the country. Even when there was plenty of people around that knew that that was not a good thing to do. But it just didn't start. It's been going on a long time. So either there's going to be one hell of a fight in this country, physical fight. I'm tired of talking, even though I'll talk a little longer. But these bastards have to be taken care of. Fuck their Homeland Security. Fuck their FBI. Fuck their CIA. They're all enemies of the white race. And if there are white people, white people involved with these people, well, then they are enemy too. So that's basically it. I don't like to hide my feelings. I don't hide behind some political party. I say what I think. And if people don't like what I think, they can kiss my white ass. And I'll be back with you tomorrow, Thursday. In the meantime, 14-5. Think of David Lane. They murdered him at Terre Haute Prison here in Indiana before I could get to him and see him. Your enemies are all here in this country. You have no enemies outside the country. And if we have outside country enemies that want to come here, then we'll kill them. We'll get the old, somebody wants to chop heads off, well, I'll get a guillotine out here and we'll see who can chop off the most heads. We can mechanize it. We can put a motor on it. We can run them through there by the dozens and dozens. But you know what? If we back off from around the world, pushing people around and occupying, they're not going to come here. They're not going to come here. That's it for today. 14-5 and shut up.
It is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. My blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't quit the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to stay great. And tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, you don't believe.
that song doesn't fit us perfectly, but it's close enough for now. I think you get the message.